This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thanks, everyone, for coming, and thanks for inviting me, Chris, and the rest of the steering committee for this summit. It's really exciting to be here, and I'm going to talk today about some past and ongoing work, and then a little bit of preview, some future work that fits or tries to fit food from the sea into the broader context of ocean health and human health. So what I'm going to talk about are these larger projects, and then I'll show you how sort of innovations we're working on to improve our assessments of food from the sea fit into our understanding of broader concepts of ocean health, and then how that affects human health. Let's see if I can get this to work. Well, this is supposed to be a wonderful spinning globe with maps that emerge, but the technology didn't work out so well. So imagine in your mind the planet spinning. And the work that I did in the past that thought about the impact of harvesting food from the sea, I looked at the cumulative impact of these various human activities and how that's affecting the ocean. And what we tried to do with that work was understand not just the impact from fishing, but how that interacts with and combines with all the other uses of the oceans to affect the natural system. And then the key point from that is, you know, harvesting food from the sea clearly has an impact, but it's just one of the many pieces, and often it's not the main piece. And especially in coastal oceans, you can get, for example, land-based pollution having a dominant effect on the natural system and the condition of the species and habitats that are within that. And that work really led me to start to think about how we get a broader, both global and regional, understanding of what are the consequences of our activities to use the ocean, and in particular to get food from the ocean. And I realized, as many others have done as well, that our interaction with the ocean is not just a negative one. And when we were doing these assessments of the cumulative impact of humans on the oceans, it really was through the lens of the negative impact that people were having on the ocean. And so under that framework or that thinking, a healthy ocean is a pristine one where you remove all human impact from the oceans. But that's clearly not a viable way to think about things, and it's not the way that most people on the planet think about their interaction with the ocean. The reason these negative impacts are happening is because we are deriving a lot of benefit from the ocean as well, and it's the interaction of our use and interaction with the ocean that derives the benefits we get from the ocean, but also then has these negative impacts. And this led me and many others to start thinking about how we can better measure and understand the overall health of the ocean with this explicit inclusion of people as part of the system, as part of the assessment of the health of that system. And when we looked at the many, many policy documents around the world, we realized that this really resonated with the way that policymakers, stakeholders, and the general public were thinking about ocean health. All of these documents, and many others not listed here, have either implicit or explicit mandates for improving the health of the ocean. And when you dig into the words that are in those documents, what they mean by the health of the ocean is a thriving human community and a thriving natural community. And if you have just one of those, you don't have a healthy system. You have to have both. But the challenge is, in all of this, there was no way to really, truly measure whether you had a healthy ocean under the definition of what these policy documents were talking about. And instead, you had a whole smorgasbord of different types of indicators out there that looked at the biophysical condition or the ecological condition or the way that human activities were affecting the ocean or sometimes some composite indicators. But there were so many and no clear way to stitch them all together. You just got overwhelmed and you couldn't make sense of it, and it wasn't really that useful to policymakers in the end because they were left trying to stitch all these pieces together themselves. So this led us to develop the Ocean Health Index, which uses existing data and information being collected across the many, many different dimensions of the way that people think about healthy oceans and measure them, to combine it into a composite measure. So this is our assessment for the first year that we did this, 2012. This is the global score. The centered number is the score for the ocean as a whole, within the EEZs, for the entire planet. And then we break this down into the 10 goals that comprise what people think of as a healthy ocean. So many of these things are the goods and services that people typically think of, like food provision or coastal protection or biodiversity. Many of them are cultural values, like tourism and recreation, or the sense of place that people derive from interacting with the ocean. And then there are ones that are clearly highly relevant to the public and policymakers, like coastal livelihoods and economies. And the length of each of these petals tells you how well that goal is doing globally relative to an ideal, optimal, sustainable level of delivery of these goals within the planet. So this is sort of planetary boundaries. And if you can fill up all of these petals and get a perfect score, you are optimizing and maximizing the sustainable delivery of this full range of benefits to people now, but making it sure that it's available for the future as well. But obviously not very many people are actually interested in a single number for the planet, because you can't do much with that from a policy perspective. So you can start to break it down and look at it by country, which we've done here. And you can start to see patterns emerging where, especially like in Central Africa, Western Africa, a lot of political conditions make it difficult for good both environmental and human community stewardship. They're getting lower scores. And often isolated, remote, uninhabited, or well-managed places are getting much higher scores. But maybe you want to start to compare particular countries, either for a competitive reason or just to understand what is different about these places and how you can learn from that to gain insight into what is making oceans healthier in some cases or unhealthy in other cases. And then you can start to track this over time to start to see how countries might be changing and what drive those changes and what policy actions may be responsible for those changes. But these are the single index numbers, and maybe you really want to understand what's going on within a particular country for each of the 10 goals that comprise the index, and you can start to see which ones are doing better and which ones are doing worse, and where you might want to prioritize your efforts to improve overall ocean health. And then, of course, you can start to track this over time. And if you do this over enough years, you can start to see potential trade-offs among these different goals and understand the consequences for not just a particular goal of interest, like food from the sea, but how that's interacting with all the other goals to impact overall ocean health. Now, one of the things you learn from doing these big global analyses is there's lots of missing information and lots of room for improvement for our understanding of particular pieces. And in fact, there's a lot of activity going on within my research group, with research groups here at Santa Barbara and across the UC system, which we're going to hear a lot about today, about how to improve our assessment and our understanding of food from the sea. And three of the things that we're working on, so there's a lot of the wild-caught fisheries stocks in the world that are data limited. We just don't have much information about them. You tend to use catch time series to try to infer how these stocks are doing, but we're working in collaboration with a lot of other groups around the world, really, in a sort of a working group model to do some model comparisons to see how these different data-limited models do and to try to come up with a synthetic outcome that takes the best of each to inform our assessments of these data poor stocks. We're also launching this year an effort to improve our per-country estimates of how much sustainable aquaculture production you can get based on both the biophysical but also the social and governance constraints within each country. And as part of that, I'm co-leading a working group that's starting this summer, funded by SNAP, for Science for Nature and People, that's pulling together a lot of people across industry, actually venture capital companies, academics, and stakeholder groups and agencies to try to tackle these questions. And then finally, I'm not leading this at all, but in collaboration with the Sea Around Us project at UBC, they've led this huge effort to do catch reconstructions to improve time series and spatial allocation of catch across the planet. And they're finding some remarkable results that catch reported to FAO, the main agency at the UN that keeps track of catch, is consistently underreporting, well, the countries are reporting to them, underreporting by 30 to 50% the catch they're actually taking. So our estimates of catch right now are way below what's actually happening on the planet. And we're going to be able to use that information to incorporate it into our assessments of how that affects overall ocean health. So we launched this Ocean Health Index in 2012. And within a year, we had a few countries, the governments of those countries, take it on to develop their own regional assessment to help inform their decision-making. By the next year, we had completed a few regional assessments ourselves, and a few other countries had started to come on board with both commitment to developing the index or interest in doing so. And this year, it's developing even more. It's really remarkable how fast the uptake of the use of this index has been by countries and organizations. And I think it really speaks to what I mentioned earlier, that there are all of these policy mandates requiring assessment of ocean health and tracking progress towards achieving that goal, but there hadn't really been a good metric for that. And so countries and organizations are hungry for something to help achieve or meet that need. So there's lots of information. The project continues to go on. We have lots of regional assessments that we're supporting and conducting. We continue to do the global assessment. We make all of our data and resources freely available, all of our code freely available. So if any of this is of interest to you, I encourage you to dive deeper at these websites and, of course, get in touch with me with any inquiries. I just want to end with sort of a preview of another project I'm getting involved with. It's actually led by some folks at Harvard in the Public Health Department. We're trying to think about how seafood fits into the human health equation. So we hear a lot about omega-3 fatty acids and also the protein from fish being great and actually necessary nutrition for many, many people around the world. But there are also a lot of micronutrients and other aspects of fish as food that are really important for human health that are harder to get from other food sources. And this is a succinct-funded working group that's just starting this year with the leaders from Harvard with grand ambitions to really make it into a large initiative that's going to try to understand how changes in the marine environment affect abundance of different types of fish, which can affect their catch, which then can affect patterns of human consumption, which can then affect the nutrition in those people that are consuming that food, in particular focus on these non-protein aspects of seafood, and then how that translates into patterns of human health. So I'm not sure where we're going to be able to get to with all this, because it is quite ambitious, but it's compiled a really great team of people. As you can see, there's sub-working groups that are tackling the links between each of these steps, and the hope is that by stitching these people with different expertise together into a single cohesive group, we'll start to be able to bridge across these transitions and really link from start to finish how changes in the marine environment affect food and then human health. I'm really excited to see what comes of that, and it's so big, we welcome all sorts of collaboration and input on this kind of a project. So I'll end there, and happy to take some questions. Yeah. It currently is not, but my hope is to start infusing that. Yeah. No, it's a great point, and as you'll hear later in the day, there's a lot of emerging work here and other places in the UC on aquaculture, and I think we're going to start to see some good synergies, and because this group is just starting, there's lots of opportunity to direct its attention, so I think that's It shortcuts the, you can get rid of the catch and fishing activity part of that equation, but everything else still matters. Fair enough. Yep. No, it's a great point. We've been. So the question was why Indonesia, New Zealand, Australia, and Philippines have not joined up. So our approach to this has actually been to let people come to us. We thought we were going to have to go out and actively recruit folks, but we've been kind of overwhelmed with interest and having to tell people, hold on, we're kind of overburdened right now. We'll get to you soon. But we're developing a whole toolbox and set of sort of software to help people do this more and more on their own. We would love to engage more countries in that region for many reasons, in particular Australia and New Zealand, maybe less these days, but historically have been global leaders in kind of conservation planning and initiatives. And so to get their expertise in doing that, engaged in this process would be fantastic. It just hasn't happened yet. So it definitely varies across each of these countries. So Colombia, they have hired people within the agencies of the government, not only to conduct the assessment, but also to then guide decisions within the government based on the outcome of that assessment. So in my mind, that's kind of the best case scenario, right? They're both leading the development of it and committed to making decisions based on that. China, it's similar. Their government is funding the development of it, and they have their SOA, the Chinese Oceanographic Association, leading it and, in theory, committed to making decisions by it. But the transparency of what happens within the Chinese government decision-making process is difficult to know. In the Baltic Sea, it's a consortium that's leading it of universities and EU kind of governing bodies that are developing it and, at least for now, committed to making decisions based on it. So exactly what that'll look like, it's too soon to say, because actually the only one that's completed it that's independent is Israel, and they're now working closely with their government. There was an NGO that developed it, but they're working closely with their government to start to craft policy that would be informed by the outcome of that assessment. But we'll see as the other ones complete how that then affects decision making. Chris.
And then on OHI, so one of the big challenges that a lot of people whether you should certify the current state or whether you should certify institutions that are in place that prediction of what the state
So we, in order to get a sense of how sustainable things are likely to be in the future, we don't model or predict the future decades in advance, but we use information on the governance and institutions that are in place that are likely to build resilience or recovery into the system, and you get essentially credit for that. So if a government were to take action, create a protected area, improve fishing regulations, something like that, they would instantly get credit for that because it's demonstrating a commitment of sorts to trying to improve the condition of the ocean. Now, you don't get a lot of credit for that because you haven't yet actually improved the state of the ocean, but if that starts to translate into improvements, you'll start to see that cascade through the index in many ways, not just for the food provision part of it, but reducing the negative impact on many of the other goals, and you'll start to get more and more credit for that action. So it's designed to reward, but in a small way, actions that show commitment towards improving things in the future, and then if they actually prove to be effective, you get more and more credit as that goes. At this point, I would say all of the above. What becomes possible to actually do, I think, will evolve. We have our first meeting in May, so I'll know a lot more after that. But it really is trying to, I mean, there. The left side is the side I'm much more familiar with, and there's many, many efforts who have done that kind of work to date. So there'll be some tweaks and innovations, I think, but the real innovation in this is going to be is linking the catch to consumption to nutrition part, because the public health people have done the nutrition to human health side of stuff a lot and thinking about how it affects the patterns of disease and disease rates and things like that. So I think we're hoping that there's some really good insights and some interesting innovations that come from linking those two halves. And I don't know yet what will be possible based on what kind of data are available and the group that we've convened.
On the OHI index that you have, I mean, take into consideration that country became important to use the OHI. So how is that affecting you?
Yeah, so it would be fantastic to track the trade and movement of all of the goods and services that are represented in all of these goals, but clearly that's incredibly difficult, if not impossible. So the approach we've taken is the country where the fish come from is responsible for the management and sustainable catch of those fish. If they choose to export it to someplace else, that's their choice, but where they export it to doesn't carry the responsibility of how it was managed in those waters. Clearly, there are issues with that because of trade agreements and political pressures and illegal fishing and so on. But until we have a lot better data and a lot better understanding of that, we had to kind of take the approach that you're responsible for your waters, and so you are assessed for what's happening in those waters.
Question about the nutritional side of it. How about contamination?
Yeah, so that's currently not on the menu of things that we're going to be trying to tackle, but clearly it's a really important topic, and it's something certainly in the developed world that lots of people pay attention to, and it's a big deal in the developing world, even if they're not paying attention to it, because there's tends to be a lot more pollution in those areas that's getting into the food system. So it may emerge as a theme that we address, but already this is massive, what we're trying to do, and the public health folks are particularly interested in these micronutrients and other things that kind of fall off the radar screen when people are typically thinking about seafood and human health, so we're trying to make some innovations there. Is there someone over there?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Clean water.
So we're trying to produce, we have a great team in place to produce as many of these support materials as possible. So I mentioned this toolbox, it's coded in R, so it's free, but we're making it as simple to use as possible, so you don't even need to know how to use R to do it. There can be a whole lot of manuals, frequently asked questions, support documents, and what we're working on this year as well is sort of a gap assessment of where we most need new information, which isn't quite what you're talking about, but also through our efforts, but also hopefully from a community sort of wiki-style effort to develop these best practices so that the countries and regions that are developing their own index start to share their lessons of what worked, what didn't work, how they overcame some of the challenges. In the end, there's no single answer on the best way to improve something, and we try not to be prescriptive about that. You may have a low score on fisheries, but it might cost a fortune to fix that, and you might better invest that money in improving ocean health across other dimensions. So the point here is actually to try to give that menu, I'll abuse the analogy, of options so that countries and policymakers and people actually can explore the costs and benefits of particular actions and choose those that fit their societal preferences best. Great. Thanks everyone.
So I'll reintroduce myself. I'm Chris Costello. I'm a professor of natural resource economics here I'm trained as an economist, but I work on in a field. One of the things I do is work in a field called bioeconomics. And I'll report today on a project and sort of a research initiative that our group and a number of other folks, some of whom are in the room, are working on, that essentially tries to address the question of, can we get more wild food from the sea? So it, in a sense, it carves out a particular one of those chunks that Ben just talked about. And in fact, I think it addresses maybe three or four of the different petals that Ben mentioned. Okay, this is a figure that many of you are probably familiar with. This is the FAO recorded landings of wild fish from the sea, starting in about 1950. And there are a couple of striking things about this, even if you just take it at face value and assume that these are the correct data, which is more or less what most of the world thinks right now, that there may be new data that suggests that this is an underestimate, but it looks something like this. And even if you inflate it by the 15 or 20, 30% that Ben talked about, it will still take a similar form. The first striking thing is that there's been a huge growth since the 50s and 60s in food production from the sea. And this is just, these are wild fish that are caught. This doesn't include aquaculture. But the second really striking thing is the flattening out you see since about 1990. And many people, including the FAO, including the World Bank, have taken that flattening out as evidence that we've kind of hit the maximum capacity of what we can get out of the sea. So, you know, basically we're at maximum sustainable yield, so let's not try to get more out of the sea. And I want to try to address that question today, whether that's accurate. So some of you that are in the field of bioeconomics will find the first 5 minutes of my talk a little bit mundane, but I want to bring, since we have a very diverse audience, I want to kind of bring everybody up to speed on how we think about these problems. So the first thing I'll try to address is, does more fishing equal more fish? Could we just go out and, you know, build more boats and go fish harder and catch more fish? You may have a preliminary answer to that already in your minds. Can we increase wild fish reproduction globally? If we do that, what is the cost to the economy? If we really want to feed all these billions of people that are going to be added to the planet with wild food from the sea, and that's essentially what I'm proposing here, is can we do that? If we want to do that, what's the cost to the economy? What's the cost to the environment? So if Ben's food provision pedal went way out, what would happen to the other pedals? Would they go out? Would they go in? And how much? That's one way to think about it conceptually. I want to discuss a couple of emerging threats and opportunities to wild production, and then say a few words about sort of costs and benefits of fishery recovery. Okay, so here's the mundane part. If you are unfamiliar with the theory of how to sort of think about fisheries in a wild fishery, this is a nice little primer for a couple of minutes. So everybody in the room has to, I think, agree to some extent that there is some hump-shaped curve that describes, for any level of fish stock, what sustainable food you can get out of the global food system, the global ocean. Okay, so if you're down here, I'm sure they're going to penalize me for talking by the mic. But if you're down here and you've caught all the fish, so there are no fish in the ocean, you're not going to get very much sustainable food out of that system. And if you're at the other extreme, way up on the other end, then you're at the carrying capacity of the global ocean. And if you want to stay there, you can't catch very many fish. Okay? And somewhere in the middle, the thing is hump-shaped, and so you can get some fish out of the ocean. That's sort of pretty obvious. So here's the no-fishing point. But, you know, let's say you just did a little bit of fishing. Maybe this is like 1970, if you recall back to the FAO graph. And you can get a, you know, sort of a decent amount of food on a sustainable basis and still have a lot of fish in the ocean. You could fish harder, have fewer fish in the ocean, and get a lot of, you know, get a pretty high fish catch, get a lot of food out of the sea. And then there's a funny thing that can happen here where you could keep fishing hard, drive the stock still further down. So now you have many fewer fish in the sea, but you're not getting any more fish than you did over here. Okay? And if you fish really hard, you end up in a place like this, where you've essentially collapsed the fish stocks and you're not getting very much food out of the sea. So this already gives you a hint about how you might be able to get more food from the sea if you've already gotten to a point like this. If you add in a little bit of economics and say, well, the sustainable food curve that I showed before is now, think of that as revenue from fishing. You know, you just multiply it by price, that's revenue from fishing. And I've drawn in the cost of fishing in the blue line here. And if you then said you switch focus from food to livelihoods of these, you know, thousands of communities around the world that rely on fishing, and you say, let's try to maximize the benefits, the economic benefits, the economic livelihoods to those communities, you'd want to go to the place where that distance is maximized, where revenues minus costs is highest. That would maximize their profits, and that's a place like this. So you'd want about that many fish. I can't walk over there, but you know, the black dot. And you'd get profits of the green line. Okay, so that looks like a pretty good place to be, at least from a community livelihood perspective. If you actually look at fish data, and I'll show some real data in a second, but we're more like at a place like this red dot right now. We've overfished to the point where we've driven fish stocks down, and so we're down at a place like the red dot, so we're getting lower food than we could even if we were just maximizing livelihoods of fishing communities. So we could be getting food, green food, if we were to recover fisheries, but instead we're right now we're getting something like red food. Okay. The other effect of recovering those fish stocks up to that point where we're maximizing profits is you get more fish in the sea. If you stick your head underwater, now you see red fish. If you were to recover fisheries to the point where you maximize profits, you'd see the black dot fish. That's a lot more fish. The way I've drawn it, maybe it's twice as many fish in the sea. You'd stick your head underwater and see twice as many fish, and you'd be catching more, and you'd be getting higher profits. So this shows the profit increase from red to green from that recovery process. Now, there's an interesting thing about institutions that I want to talk about, and Ben didn't really address this. I know it's part of his team's research efforts, and I really think it needs to be central in this Whole Food from the Sea initiative, and that is, what institutions do we use to recover fisheries or to maintain healthy oceans? It's not just about what does the ecosystem look like. It's what institutions do we use to govern and sort of influence the way people behave to give rise to those ecosystem effects. And there's a class of fisheries approaches that a number of us are studying that tends to give rise to higher prices because of higher quality fish. And so the black line shifts up, and to lower costs, because if you use the right institutions, you can fish more efficiently, which lowers the blue line down. So even if you keep the fish stock in the same place in the new profit location, you could get much higher profits. That is, communities could be a lot better off if you adopted certain kinds of institutions rather than other kinds of institutions. And we can talk about the details of that if you have questions about it. Okay, so that's kind of the bioeconomics 101, all right? Give you a sense of how we're thinking about this. And what we thought we would try to do, and you know, we kind of came up with this probably over beer some night, and we're now, you know, facing the brutal reality that it's hard to do in practice. But the idea we had was, let's take a model like that, and let's go gather data on every fishery in the world that we can gather data on, 6,000 fisheries around the world, and actually try to model what the potential upside is along these three dimensions: the food dimension, the livelihood or profits dimension, and the fish biomass or conservation dimension. Okay, so can we actually try to model what would happen in Indonesia compared to what would happen in New Zealand from adopting new fishery management approaches? And then if you aggregate all those up, what's the potential globally of recovering wild fisheries in order to achieve those three objectives? So that's the goal of this project. And we want to be able to address I took all these pictures because we get to go around the world and look at this kind of stuff, and it's really interesting. We want to address fisheries at various scales. So some of these are very small scale. This is a small scale fisherman in Cambodia. This is the kind of stuff he was catching. This is a kind of medium scale fishery in Peru from an artisanal fleet on the coast of Peru that we visited, and they're catching all kinds of stuff, you know, sort of whatever they happen to find they're going to catch. And this is a picture, I did not take this one, This is a picture from China. That in China, the way they manage the trawl fishery in the East China Sea is, each of these is an enormous trawl fishing vessel. The only way they manage the fishery is a three-month closed season in the summer. And then in September, they open the gates, and that's the gate, that red thing. And they say, go, and everybody goes. And there are just thousands of huge trawl boats that leave this port. And we went and visited this port a couple of months ago. And they all leave this port on the same day, and they all go out and catch whatever they can trawl fishing. So we want to address small, medium, and large-scale fisheries around the world through this kind of recovery analysis. These are some fish we saw and then ate in China that were caught by that fleet. Okay, so the approach here is a stock-by-stock analysis that starts by trying to estimate the current biological status. You know, there's a huge amount of detail in every one of these bullets, so I'll just give you the highlights, just as in Ben's talk, and then I'm happy to answer any detailed questions. So we start by estimating where does that fishery stand now relative to where it could be. We estimate things like prices and costs in that fishery, and then our goal is to project forward, project into the future under different possible management scenarios. So we have a status quo scenario. If you keep doing what you're doing now, what will happen into the future? Will you continue to decline? Will you level out? Will you increase? And honestly, we've found all three cases can be true. In some parts of the world, like the United States, we've taken very strong action in the last 10 or 15 years to recover fish stocks. So the status quo is actually for fish stocks to recover in the U.S. If you don't do anything new in the U.S., you're going to see a lot more fish underwater 10 years from now than you see right now. Okay, but if you go to Vietnam, that's probably not the case. The status quo is for a decline. And, you know, different countries have different outcomes there. So we have a status quo scenario. We have an optimized yield. If you're just trying to maximize food production, how much food can you get? How long will it take to get there? And what kind of recovery does it require in, you know, in Chile compared to in Iceland? We're going to model what we call a catch share scenario, which is an institutional reform that gives rise to kind of maximizing profits of fisheries. What are the biological implications of that? What are the economic implications? What are the food provision implications? These are actually the optimized yield is optimizing profits by managing the yield of the fishery. And the bottom one is optimizing food by managing the yield of the fishery. So they're slightly different. Maximizing profits, you tend to have a higher stock of fish in the water than if you're just trying to maximize food. And you remember that from the little theory section I did at the beginning. So then what we want to do is for each of these policies, we want to compare the trajectories across different objectives. And really what we're interested in is there a triple bottom line? Can you get increases in food while you get increases in profits, while you get increases in conservation or biomass of fish all at the same time? And we're finding that in many fisheries and in most countries of the world, the answer is yes. Okay, so then once you have that, you can start thinking about prioritizing recovery efforts. Should you focus on Southeast Asia, or should you focus on South America, or focus on North America? What are the fisheries or countries or regions with the greatest potential gains? And which recovery approaches, which policy interventions give rise to which outcomes that you desire? Okay, so this all sort of hinges, this triple bottom line idea hinges on the concept of fishery recovery. The idea that you've overexploited the stock, you've driven it down to the red dots that I showed earlier, and you want to recover it to get these benefits. And so one way to achieve recovery is through, as I mentioned earlier, institutional reform. And one nice thing about institutional reform is that if you do it in the right way and give fishermen a stake in the health of the fishery, so the idea is to create new rules of the game so that fishermen get a stake in the long-term health of the fishery, they will have a financial incentive to try to help motivate the reform. As opposed to telling fishermen, well, just stop fishing for 10 years and in 10 years things will be great. That's a hard pill for a fisherman to swallow because he's the one who takes the hit and somebody else gets the benefit later. But if he has an asset that he owns and that asset's value is tied to the future health of the fishery, then this may be a way to recover fisheries and have current fishermen actually endorse that. Okay, then of course the timing of recovery depends on what institutions you implement, but also on the biology of the fish stocks. Some stocks, for example, off the West Coast here, West Coast groundfish fishery, which has undertaken one of these institutional reforms, many of those stocks are very slow growing and take, you know, decades or even, you know, 2-3 decades to recover. Other stocks are very, very quick to recover, things like sardines or anchovies, these forage fish fisheries. So different fish species will recover in different across different timescales. Just to give you some very preliminary results from this analysis, and it's still ongoing, so none of this is published yet, but just to give you an idea, we estimate that, in fact, we can increase global food production if through this recovery process, and that that will increase global wild food from the sea by something like 15% to 40%, depending on the scenario, relative to what we're getting now. So that flat line, we think, can go up by at least 15%. But here's the important thing. If we think that's not the right counterfactual. The right counterfactual is not what we're getting now. The right counterfactual is what will we be getting in 20 years or so if we don't take action now? And the answer is we think that line would go down. The yield from the sea will go down over time if we don't act now. That's because most countries of the world are overfishing right now. And so if you compare to that scenario, the recovery scenario is over a 50% increase in food. And that those increases in food production typically arise in tandem with increases in fish in the sea and profits to those communities. This is sort of an example of the type of figure we're going to be able to produce when this analysis is done. The horizontal axis here is the percentage increase in the biomass of the fish, you know, the biomass of fish in the water. The vertical axis is the percentage increase in the total catch. So, for example, 100% increase would be a doubling of catch. Each dot is a country, and the size of the dot scales to the increase in profits. So we've tried to capture the triple bottom line, but at a country level here. And I don't want you to take the dots too seriously yet because these are very preliminary results, but this is the sort of figure we're going to be able to produce. And then once I put, you know, I'm not going to do it now, but eventually we'll put labels on those so you know which country's which, and you start to get a sense of what regions of the world are, you know, have the largest potential gains from recovery. We can also look at timing of these different effects because, you know, we know the composition of fish stocks in Indonesia and we know the composition of fish stocks in Western Africa. And so we can actually model out what the timing of these effects are likely to be. I want to conclude with just a couple of caveats and sort of areas of future research that we're really engaged in. And this is, I think, the most interesting one, and that is what is the effect of climate change likely to be on fish production? And this is a figure from Chung et al., a paper that came out, I believe, in Nature a few years ago that looked at the changes in fish production around the world. Ben Halpern and his lab is working on a sort of a different version of this, and we're collaborating with Ben on what the analysis I'm about to talk about. So the basic question here is, if you think about recovering fisheries ignoring climate change, sort of assuming that the climate's going to stay constant over in the future, you get a very different picture of the world than if you take those climate forecasts into account. So if you know that the tropics are going to become less productive, for example, you may change your recovery strategy relative to the case where you sort of ignore climate change. And we're interested in how that changes, how incorporating climate change changes what you want to do today. So it's not just, you know, gosh, everything's going to die under climate change. It's not that kind of analysis. It's if you know with the places where climate change is going to improve productivity and the places where it's going to make things worse, how does that change what you do today? And the other big caveat or area of future research is in the kind of ecosystem effects, sort of the food web and trophic structure of global fisheries. And I don't really have enough time to talk about the details here, but what we're thinking of here are institutions that can be put in place that account for these ecosystem effects. things like multi-species ITQs, transferable habitat quotas. I know Kurt is here, and he's worked on this issue. Marine reserves and property rights, and then other things like plankton shares. You know, what if you had an ITQ on plankton instead of on the higher trophic levels? I expect I'll get a few questions about that. So let me just conclude by saying that the reason I'm attracted to fisheries as an intellectual endeavor is that I think it's one of these rare environmental challenges where the triple bottom line really is possible. You know, there's almost always some trade-off between the economy and the environment, but it's not really true in fisheries. If you want to maximize profit in fisheries, you need a lot of fish in the ocean. And if you do that, you're going to have high yields from fisheries. So there really aren't big trade-offs across these three dimensions. They're pretty well aligned, and I think that makes for a very compelling story. And I think it also suggests we ought to do something because, you know, everything else is sort of hard to solve. This one's easy. And we find that there is this triple bottom line globally, if you look at all the data and analyze it in the way we have, but that those effects will be heterogeneously distributed across the world and might take 5 to 10 years to achieve. And we sort of give some hints about the policy instruments that are likely to get us there. So I guess the last thing I'll say is I think cross-disciplinary collaborations like this one here, but then I think like others that we're going to hear about, are really essential to getting this stuff right. Because, you know, an economist obviously can't get the ecosystem stuff right, just like an ecologist doesn't really know how to think about institutions or policy design or economic effects. So I think putting all of these things together and the human health side and other dimensions that we haven't included here really can help provide a much richer picture of what we ought to do and what the consequences of those actions are likely to be. Thank you very much. Ben. I think you should wait for the mic.
So people typically talk about the triple bottom line as equity and the environmental and economic benefits, and you hint at issues of equity and the heterogeneous distribution. I'm wondering if you've looked at that much to understand how these upside analysis might distribute across not just countries, but within countries, yeah. Stakeholders.
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben, about equity. I think there are a number of, so we have thought about that, and there are a number of scales at which one can analyze the equity question. At a broad scale, you know, one way to think about it is if you were to recover global fisheries, which countries would gain the most, which countries would gain the least, sort of at a country scale. And one of the interesting findings there is that there are a number of countries who aren't going to gain very much. Okay, and I'll give you an example is New Zealand. New Zealand is a place that has very healthy fish stocks. You know, they have some issues, but basically they're healthy on average. And they have institutions that are already in place to maximize benefits to their fisheries, to maximize economic benefits to their fisheries. So you really can't squeeze much more out of New Zealand. I mean, they're pretty much optimizing. Their pedal is out at 100%, if you will. Many Southeast Asian countries have adopted none of the approaches to recover fish stocks, so their stocks have declined. And they lack the institutions to, even if they were at the right fish stock, to maximize economic benefits. So they're likely to gain a lot in many dimensions. So we were finding that it actually is the case that a lot of developing world countries are the ones that are likely to gain the most. So that's kind of that's good. I like that story. At a micro level, so within a country, who wins and who loses, I think fundamentally comes down to institutions. Because we can design the same institution that gives rise to the same fish stock recovery, and in one version, those benefits are heterogeneous or are distributed widely in the economy, and in another version, they're concentrated or they're much smaller. I don't know what the right answer is, but we can say something about what institutions give rise to what effects. Hunter.
Wondering if you had a feeling or ideas about the social, economic, or environmental factors that help activate and makes new institutions successful.
Yeah,
But what When you've seen instances of success, what are some of the underlying?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough and really interesting question. You know, maybe I'll just say a quick comment about that. If you think about the world as we've got to manage the amount of fish catch, and this is how fishery scientists are trained to think about the world. Okay, we've got to manage this amount of fish that come out of the sea. I think you're completely missing the point on the issue that you're raising here, okay? Because what you start to implement are things like season closures like they have in China, or gear restrictions, or area closures, things like that to manage your fisheries. These are institutions that essentially create an incentive for fishermen to go to the regulators and say, let us catch more fish. And you see this everywhere in the world. Okay, you show me a country, and I'll show you a fishery that's managed that way that has that result. If instead, if you want to recover fish stocks and you want the current fishermen to have a stake in that so that they want the recovery to happen, you have to give them some way to care about the long-term benefits. It can't be the case that they bear the brunt of it and someone else gets the benefit, or else they're not going to be willing to undertake those recovery efforts. The situations that I've seen work, and New Zealand is a good example of this, is you give them an asset and a secure right to be a participant in the future fishery. And when you do that, all of a sudden they want the fish stock to recover because they know that they can make more money in the long run by doing that. But, you know, that's, and whether you can do, how you do that in, let's say, the coast of Cambodia or the coast of India, is hard. It's not going to be the same way that you do it in New Zealand, but we've thought a lot about that problem, and there are examples from the developing world that have worked. So I think there are ways to design these institutions that are sort of context conditional, but not every place gets its own design. There's sort of a few buckets that work in different places. Yeah.
I'll give it to you.
Oh, okay.
On the first figure you have.
Yeah, let me try it. I don't know if I'm going to.
You talk about the catch increase until you reach a plateau. Have you ever taken into consideration about gear efficiency as we catching fish more efficient?
Yes, excellent point. So yeah, I think what you're saying, let me see if I got this right. So this guy right here, why did we plateau is I think your question, and what does it have to do with gear efficiency? And I think it has a lot to do with gear efficiency. You could be driving the stock down and still maintain the same catch if your gear is becoming more efficient. And I think that's absolutely right. The other thing that I think is going on here is you drive stock X down until it reaches a low level. Then you start fishing on stock Y, and you drive it down. Then you start fishing on stock Z, and you keep doing that. And it looks like the global catch is constant, but in fact, you're depleting stock after stock after stock. And if you look at the data, that seems to be what's happening in many parts of the world.
So if you were to plug in the gear efficiency from 1960 to 1980, maybe you have a plateau too using the same gear. We keep depleting the fish
in
the ocean.
Exactly.
And increasing the gear efficiency.
Exactly. And this, I think you're helping me make my point that we shouldn't look at this and assume that it's perfectly correlated with fish stock. It's not. It's not correlated with fish stock. This is the compilation of 6,000 fisheries that are all being, you know, many of which are being depleted by gear innovations and things like that. Now, I should also say the other thing that's happening up in that plateau is places like the U.S. and New Zealand and other parts of the world have substantially reduced their catch to recover stocks. And, you know, so if in China and Southeast Asia they're increasing catch, and in the U.S. they're decreasing their catch, you have to sort of average all that out, and that's what we're trying to do with this stock-by-stock analysis. Oh, actually, we had a question here. Okay, I'll let you manage this. Bruce.
Chris, you alluded at the very end to trophic interactions and other ecosystem-based effects. As I understand, the assessment you've done is on a single-species basis. How do you think the, so there's issues of institutions for multiple species, but how do you think the potential triple bottom line will change when you take into account the fact that fish eat fish?
Yes, they do. Okay, we've thought a little bit about this, and I'll keep my comments brief, but yeah, we'd love to hear your thoughts if you have them. So the sort of the 800-pound gorilla with this, with respect to ecosystem effects in terms of wild global fisheries, are the forage fish. So they're a huge percentage of global biomass, they're a huge percentage of global catch, and they're the stuff that the bigger fish eat. Okay, so if you, at a first order, if you want to try to capture this, you have to think about, well, you can't manage forage fish at MSY and expect all the tunas and the salmon and the other stuff to thrive. Okay, and so there was a report by Len Fest and Tim Essington and his group at UW recently published a report on this, and basically one of their recommendations was to decrease the catch of forage fish by 25%. So go from MSY to 75% of MSY for forage fish, to leave a third for the birds, even though it's not really a third, but it sounds good. Leave a third for the birds. And so we have implemented that. So the results I showed you and our analysis, for every forage fish species, we estimate MSY from stock assessments, and we decrease it by 25% to account for that. So that's like a little way in which we're trying to capture the food web. The other thing that we're doing indirectly is, because we're using published stock assessments, we have about 450 of them around the world now, for much of the analysis, those assessments are done in a food web. So when you measure growth rates and fish stock and carrying capacity of species X, that happens within a food web. So to some extent, that's implicitly capturing the food web effects, even though it's not explicit. So those are two ways in which we're capturing it. I think it could be done in a better way, but we didn't want to build a global food web model because we think that gets messy and has its own problems. I think we have time for maybe one more. Yeah.
Is this on?
Yes.
Oh, there we go. I noticed you used the word profit in kind of a really broad brush. I the profit difference between that little guy and his wooden boat and a multinational hedge fund extractive process is quantitative. How do you deal with that?
Well, a dollar is a dollar, so I don't see the difference. I think that it comes down to equity. So if you care more about the little guy in his boat and you think he deserves the dollar more than the hedge fund guy, I love the hedge fund image, but then that's an equity question, and a certain type of institution may give rise to higher profits to the first type of outfit than the second type. And we can say something about that. But when I mentioned profit here, it was just revenues minus costs in the fishery without regard for who they accrue to. So I think it's important to look at that, and different institutions will favor one type of player over another. But when I say there's a triple bottom line, I'm saying there's a potential for profits, revenues minus costs, to go up at the same time as increases in yield and biomass. I think we probably ought to move on to coffee. So we're going to have a short break, and then we'll reconvene at 10:15. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.